Maximum Health with your host, Dr. Ken Gray. Dr. Gray obtained his master's in both acupuncture and oriental medicine from the Atlantic Institute of Oriental Medicine. Dr. Gray enjoys both being a physician as well as being an educator. His unique approach to holistic healing has taken him abroad to lecture in Germany and treat sports professionals in Hawaii and France. He is co-author of several books on food therapy. His office is in Jupiter, Florida, where he has practiced for over a decade and where he resides. Now it's time for Maximum Health with Dr. Ken Gray.
Welcome, everyone. This is Maximum Health, Quality Living with yours truly, Dr. Ken Gray. Thank you for joining us this beautiful Friday at 7 p.m. We love knowing that there are people out there that really value their health, their world, and we just want to bring you the best in authorities in all walks of life, in all walks of health, and that's what I've been doing for the last 3 years. I've looked to really bring to the forefront of the idea of health and what it really truly means, the fact that it is about social health, emotional health, physical health, environmental health, financial, spiritual. So that being said, if we can really get a collective of people talking and really enlightening us, then we have done our job. And that's what I try to do every week with a new guest. During this show, I'd like to give you a sampling of our past. And this way you'll get a good taste of what's to come. The first show is one on pancreatic cancer. I want to reflect there because that was one opportunity I had, one of a few opportunities I had to speak with Senthil Mathaswamy and Jim Moser, who have been pioneering the whole idea of pancreatic cancer being something of the past. And they're doing this through the growing of organelles, which you're going to hear about in a second, as well as genetics and artificial intelligence melding together to give us early detection and a more precise or attempt at precision medicine to beat this thing.
Precision medicine, what really usually refers to is knowing the mutations or the changes that are present in the genes of the tumor cell and then tailoring a treatment towards those mutations. So hopefully we'll have a better response than giving a one-size-fits-all approach. That's the basic concept. What we decided to do about 4 years ago is really take look at the other side of the coin, which is if you can take the patient's cells from the tumor and grow them in the lab, and now expose these cells to multiple drugs that are potentially available for the cancer patients, and then simply ask which combination or the which drugs actually is very effective in killing the patient and tumor cells in the lab, and then go to the clinic and deliver that to the patient. This is the mindset in which we started. And what we have accomplished, and we reported this last year, is that we, in fact, can grow patient tumor, pancreatic tumors, surgically isolated by surgeons like Jim Moser, in the lab, grow them as mini tumors that retains the property of the tumor cell that was originally in the patient tumor. And now you expose them to drugs and then find out how do you match the treatment to the patient.
So much of medicine, as we've learned, can be a lot about science and about research. But a lot of that's funded by people with big hearts and also big wallets. Fundraising and passions come together to create foundations. Sometimes there's a name of that creates that presence that we can stand by and say, okay, we know that our funds and our attention and our passions are going to go in the right direction. I had this one show that I was fortunate enough to have Patty McDonald, who's the CEO of the Nicholas Children's Foundation. And Nicholas Children's Foundation does what it says. It focuses on children's health, and it's become a national as well as international presence, an advocate for children's health. They have done so much in our community here in the Treasure Coast. So let's take a second and listen to Patty McDonald as she gives us some insight into the Nicholas Children's Foundation.
There are three really areas of excellence mm-hmm. at Nicholas Children's Hospital, and that is cardiac and neurology okay. and cancer.
Okay.
So those are the children that really need that specialized care. And mm-hmm. there are a lot of children that are born with cardiac issues. Mm-hmm. And it's very important that they get that care right away. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes it is diagnosed ahead of time, as I was mentioning. So yeah. Dr. Drosner, for instance, who is at the Nicholas Children's Outpatient Center here mm-hmm. in Palm Beach Gardens, is actually doing that fetal heart monitoring. Mm-hmm. So they're monitoring the baby
right.
Before the baby is born. And the Nicholas Children's Hospital is actually going to be looking to open a 10-bed maternity ward within the hospital itself. So if you know as a mother that you're going to deliver a critical child, you will be able to deliver that child at the Nicklaus Children's Hospital so that you're not at an adult hospital and that baby now has to be transferred via ambulance. Okay. So that's going to change things dramatically for these babies.
You know, I had the pleasure of having Dr. Drosner.
Yes. So you want the, you know, the team approach.
Right.
If your child is going to have heart surgery or brain surgery,
God forbid.
You want the whole team. Yeah. You want the doctors, you want the nurses, you want the facility, you want the anesthesiologist. Mm-hmm. You want everyone that's really focused on that particular issue. Mm-hmm. And you can't duplicate that all across the state. So that's why you have certain children's hospitals that are the best at what they do. Mm-hmm. And then you can have a community hospital like Jupiter Medical Center that's able to help families that don't need maybe that level of care,
right,
but they don't want to leave their community to have to get care.
Right.
So that's what's so amazing about what we've been able to do is to have that care here at Jupiter Medical Center, but still be able to work with the doctors at the main hospital. So telemedicine is incredible.
There are very few areas of healthcare that we still leave up to nature. And when I wanted to explore one in particular that I felt very close to, I chose midwifery. And midwifery for some of you is so foreign and such an area of fear and uncertainty. I was fortunate, however, to have Tammy on our show, Tammy the midwife. She really just shared so many of her wonderful experiences and gave us some good cues on who would be appropriate versus who wouldn't. And here's an excerpt from that show.
People, I think, have some misconceptions to what this whole role is in midwifery and what we do at birth. I think a lot of people think that we just have this trust birth at all capacity type thing, and that that it goes great when it goes great, and if it doesn't, there's a mess. And that's not at all true. Midwives today practice evidence-based medicine.
Mm-hmm.
They come well-prepared. We carry most of the things, whether it be at home or at the birth center, we are carrying most of the supplies you would see in a standard delivery room at a hospital.
Sometimes more.
Yeah, so a lot more. So
I remember that you employ things like
equipment,
the Doppler, which is not something
exactly.
An average.
And then there's also alternative type things, too. So there's things like resuscitation equipment, the same type of IV fluids, and medications to stop a postpartum hemorrhage. The exact same things you would see in a hospital, plus alternatives, some healthy alternatives, some wise choices, too, at those births. So we come with this very prepared knowing and a lot of practice and a lot of skills in evidence-based medicine. Mm-hmm. But we also know that birth isn't necessarily a medical three-ring circus.
Right.
And our main job as midwives is to guard the space emotionally, physically, sometimes spiritually, as that particular woman and that particular baby needs.
Mm-hmm.
So we come knowing her relationship sometimes with her sisters, her husband, mm-hmm. her mother, what kind of history she has in her life. Was there trauma? Was it a, you know, was there not? So that we have an idea of what she's going to need to get through this with love and lots of preventative care and lots of pre-education going mm-hmm. into this. And sometimes it doesn't go perfect.
Right.
Sometimes it bumps off of a totally natural path or normal path, and it is our job as midwives to identify when that is happening and to help bump it back onto a safe path for that mom and baby.
Right.
Sometimes we use some of that equipment and our skills to bump it back on. Sometimes we use some of that to maintain safety as a delivery is happening. And sometimes, rarely, we have to use that, those skill sets and that equipment to hold safety as we maintain it, as we transfer to a higher level of care.
Right.
So sometimes about 4% of our moms will deliver in a hospital setting when they're transferred during labor.
Hmm. With sensitivities in mind, is this a class situation? You know, is this an issue where you see certain people from different classes, financial classes, choose midwifery over others?
Not at all.
Okay.
One day I'll be in a one-room home where literally 8 people may live.
Right.
And the next day I'll be in the biggest house where I have echoes coming out of me on Hutchinson Island as I'm calling for my staff.
Right.
I have doctors,
yeah,
OBs themselves or their wives, alternative physicians like yourself, chiropractors, school teachers,
yeah,
mechanics, all crosses of life come in,
right,
seeking a different type of birth experience.
When it comes to women's health, the fight against breast cancer has been mainly led by the Susan G. Komen Foundation. Executive Director Davey Gabbard joined me on Maximum Health to share some details on how far we've come as a nation in this fight.
We want people to understand that there's hope,
right,
and that there, if we find the breast cancer early when it is isolated to the breast, you have a very, very, very high chance, a 99% chance,
right,
of a 5-year relative survival rate. And that was, it was in the 70s percentile, mm-hmm, you know, in the 70s and 80s when the organization was first founded. You couldn't say breast cancer on TV or the radio.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They wouldn't print breast cancer in the obituary or in the newspaper. When Nancy Brinker started the organization, she couldn't get publicity because they wouldn't put the word breast cancer in print.
Wow.
So you also have to think about how this movement has paralleled the women's empowerment movement,
yeah,
and where we've come from since the late 70s to where we are now as far as being open and. You know, they didn't know if it was contagious or not.
Right.
They knew, but people thought it was contagious. Susie would walk down the street. She was a very well-known member of her community in Peoria. And people would cross the street if they saw her coming because they didn't know if it was contagious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's been a lot of questions about all the money that's been invested in. Where's the cure? Why haven't we found it yet? Well, we know so much more than we knew then.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we understand there are 8 subtypes of breast cancer. We are now looking at the genetic makeup of not only the patient, but the genetics of the cancer itself, and really focusing on precision medicine. That's mm-hmm. the future.
That is where a lot of focus has,
mm-hmm.
On this show over the years, I've featured a lot of that. I've had the CEO of Berg, who is also working with that in pancreatic cancer.
Mm-hmm.
We have alliances of families fighting pancreatic cancer, and a lot of that in breast cancer and cervical cancer. I mean, all of this
mm-hmm.
has this sort of tie-in with precision medicine, because not only are we able to, through it, there's going to be some better early detection, but the treatment processes
mm-hmm.
will be unique to the individual.
Absolutely.
And so there won't be a lot of wasting of time, wasting
mm-hmm.
of resources,
mm-hmm.
wasting of finance.
Absolutely.
Which becomes an issue. And going into that part of it, how you mentioned aid,
mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the times you think, well, if I have breast cancer, what's going to happen, to my family?
Right.
How are we going to survive this, and how are we going to pay for it?
Exactly.
And so for those people listening that don't have those resources, how do they tap into that with Susan G. Komen?
So, if they need screening, the first thing that you need to do is go to your doctor and, have a clinical breast exam, talk
right.
to them about your family history on your mother and your father's side of the family. While the majority of patients don't have a known genetic mutation, there's got to be more out there that we haven't discovered yet.
Mm-hmm.
Komen is researching that. But if you have a family history of other types of cancer, including breast cancer, it's important that you and your doctor talk about that so that they understand what the screening protocols are appropriate for you.
For so many of us, the term PTSD entered our lives through movies on what happened post-war for soldiers. But I had an author, Michelle Rosenthal, who joined me to speak on women with PTSD, as well as other individuals who had never been involved with war. So it was really enlightening to learn how many people in our nation suffer from PTSD and the ways that we tend to deal with them, good and bad. Here's a bit on that.
We have a large community on HealMyPTSD.com, and it spans everything from veterans and military service to child abuse, sexual assault, natural disasters, car accidents, life-threatening illnesses, domestic violence. I mean, I could go on and on. So what I really think of when I think of PTSD is that life-threatening experience that
mm-hmm.
you either witness yourself or you see or you see somebody else going through.
Mm-hmm.
And then the immediate, you used this word before, shock, the
mm-hmm.
shock and the surprise that overwhelms our ability to cope. And this happens both on psychological levels and also, as you know, as a physician, neurophysiological levels.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Trauma changes our brain. It changes our body.
Yeah.
And so when I think of PTSD, I think of the symptoms of hyperarousal, re-experiencing, avoidance, mood
mm-hmm.
alterations,
mm-hmm.
combined with a disconnection from the internal self
right.
that's really at the seat of powerlessness.
The thing that brought this sort of diagnosis or the PTSD and made it a household name was obviously certain recent movies, correct, that involve veterans returning from war and dealing with, either not being able to cope with everyday life or family life and then needing to go back to that place where they feel comfortable which is actually in the stress, in the seat of stress, high stress.
That's so true. Yeah. I really think that 9/11 brought PTSD so much more to the forefront because the media started covering it.
Right.
And we have these great movies now like Hurt Locker and American Sniper.
Right.
And I think that's great because the media is starting to really raise awareness. And what we really need is education so that everybody understands you don't have to have had military service to have post-traumatic stress disorder. Right. But once you do, we're all sort of in the same spot. When I first started, I came out of my recovery. I was 40 years old. I had no life. I had no career, no family, no relationship. PTSD had consumed me, and I didn't know what to do with myself, and I just started blogging about my PTSD experience, thinking my trauma was so rare. Only 1 in 2 million people per year experience it, so nobody's going to understand me. The very first people to start commenting on my blog saying, how did you just put into words exactly how I felt for 20 years? We're veterans. Mm-hmm. How are you writing about what I feel? They wrote to me.
How would you know?
Right. I don't know how I'm writing that. I'm writing how I feel. Yeah. And that was really pivotal in my understanding of PTSD. We are so individual in our trauma.
Yes.
And yet so universal.
For many of us, vanity is part of humanity. So it's just important to remember that health and beauty go hand in hand. And so for some tips on that, we had a wonderful conversation with Heather Gray. What is the most popular reason someone would search you out for beautification? You know, what is the modality that you most do?
Well, there's plenty of different streams bringing clientele into the office. They may be interested. Maybe they're brought to us for a Mohs repair to correct a skin cancer lesion that needs to, you know, correction and to be healed properly. Perhaps they actually are coming in to consult with a doctor about a cosmetic procedure, or maybe they just want to come in for some injections. Or if they're, you know, specifically coming to me through skin, you know, there's many treatments that we offer at the office that that I perform, such as, of course, facials and chemical peel treatments.
Right.
IPL treatments, Ultherapy treatments, which is ultrasound skin tightening.
That one is fairly new, right?
About five years.
5 years?
Yeah.
That is an alternative or pre sort of treatment or facelift without surgery. Am I correct?
Not quite a surgical result, but it can tighten the skin. It can give a little, a little extra time before that surgery is
So some people have done this, say that's like amazing results, like realistically amazing.
It really is. And it's from a device to be able to come from a device that delivers, you know, waves of ultrasound. It's pretty, you know, fantastic. It's a little uncomfortable, definitely. We do our best to manage that in the office, but, you know.
So non-surgical, using sound to tighten the skin. And how many treatments?
One. It lasts about, we're seeing about results going about 2 years. Lately, we are now doing micropen treatments with PRP, and this is the latest and greatest, and people are just flocking to the office for this.
I mean, the biggest thing is, years ago, it started sort of surfacing because of sports greats using PRP, flying to Belgium and all these places to get the plasma taken from their own blood and reinjected into joint spaces and things to renew and heal in a fast way.
Correct.
You're taking this now, and it's being used in the aesthetic community for, how does it work with the face?
Well, the same way. We do a blood draw. So it's about, you know, just one tube of blood that we take, and we put that in a centrifuge, spin it down, separating the red blood cells from the platelet-rich plasma. So what's left behind is basically a light yellow serum that we're going to apply to the skin after doing a micropen treatment. And the micropen treatment is basically, as you would expect, it's little micro needles creating tiny pathways into the skin for this PRP to be massaged in after the micropen is performed. The PRP is full of your natural growth factors and cytokines, which allows the skin to behave younger.
Sports and recreation is a huge aspect of quality living, and golf for many is a passionate part of their lives. I see a lot of patients that live and breathe by golf. But here in Florida, we have the Honda Classic, and I was fortunate to speak with John Curran, one of the pro golfers, as well as some of the head people in charge of the Honda Classic. And we spoke on charity and commitment to a better community. Speaking of meaningful, we've been tying in the Honda Classic with, you know, the Nicholas Children's Foundation, the Tiger Woods, and all these different causes that it supports every year for the last 35 mm-hmm. years. And Dana, DJ, we can call her now because we just dubbed her DJ, Dana Johnson, the community outreach, she's sort of given us some insight into how much work goes into Honda Classic and how much work actually goes into the community outreach through these foundations. Even the Ernie Els School, which is helping to change lives here with autism, and is supported. So I was wondering, what cause do you really support?
Well, I have a pretty close connection with melanoma. My father actually passed away recently, 4 years ago, a few days ago, actually.
I'm sorry to hear that.
4 years ago. Yeah. Well, he had melanoma, and it was a pretty serious disease. I mean, we didn't know really as a family, we didn't know much about it until he had it and went through it, and we all went through it, and it was it's a lot more than just skin cancer. I mean, it can metastasize and turn into all these really nasty things. And I think we thought originally that it's not a very serious thing, but it can be very, very serious. So my sister and my mom, every year we try to reach out and donate some money and do some causes for children's skin, just children's awareness for skin cancer and skin protection and stuff like that in the Massachusetts area.
Much better to start when you're early being aware than to have to catch up when you're older, huh? So
absolutely. And with my father, I think it was when he was younger. He was 65 years old, so he was growing up in like the 50s and 60s. And not that they didn't have any skin protection for a son and stuff like that, but I don't think it was as widespreadly used back then. And I think a lot of the trouble that he ran into was already happened. So I mean, I think it's good to get out ahead of it.
Last summer, Central and South Florida suffered a horrible tragedy due to overflow of fresh water into the brackish water and all the way to the ocean due to an algae bloom. A lot of fish were dying. Fishermen were suffering. Whole communities were suffering. There were toxins in the air. And I had to reach out to the Florida Oceanographic Society to get some real details on what was happening on a whole and what should we do going forward. So here's Mark Perry with some of that show. The biggest, newest problem that we've created as human beings called algae bloom.
Well, it's not new. We've had it since about 2004. This is about the eighth time in the St. Lucie estuary where this algae bloom has started in Lake Okeechobee. And what it is a cyanobacteria. It's a blue-green algae that acts as a normal kind of algae, but when it gets the right conditions of warmer water temperatures, sunlight, and of course a lot of nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen, it begins to bloom. It multiplies, and as it blooms and multiplies, it goes through its life cycle, and as the cells break down, they give off a microcystin toxin. And this particular algae, Microcystin arenosa, is a basically a blue-green algae that has been known to be associated with this, not only the microcystin toxin as a cell's lysis, but also the BMAA, which is a very big concern because that association has been known to cause ALS and Parkinson's and
Alzheimer's. Yeah, neurological issues.
So there are neurological and hepatotoxin issues that come with this algae.
Hepatotoxin meaning liver toxicity, yeah.
So when this algae bloom happened in the lake this year in May, we were already getting, since January 30th, already getting discharges from the lake because the lake had gotten so high.
Right.
And as we mentioned earlier, they were trying to get the lake level down in preparation for tropical storm season, right? So much rain was coming, El Nino and all that, so they were discharging from the lake. Along comes this algae bloom in mid-May. It followed its course of the water, with the water right out of the lake, out the St. Lucie Canal, and even down the L8 Canal and Palm Beach Canal into Lake Worth Lagoon, but also into the St. Lucie and the Indian River Lagoon. And what we ended up with is this bright green algae because it could be sustained by the freshwater. It's not a saltwater algae.
Right.
It's a freshwater algae.
Right.
So it's sustained by the freshwater, the nutrients, the sunlight, the warm temperature. And here comes this big algae bloom. And, of course, it got into marinas, into boat ramp areas, and as it accumulates, it got to some places 6 or 8 inches thick.
Right.
And as it built up that thickness, it begins to break down and decompose, and of course gives off this odor. So people were getting nausea and vomiting. They were getting irritated throats and sore eyes. And so there was a big concern health-wise, not even just from touching it.
A truly advanced and healthy society has art at the forefront of its sort of presence. It's in the schools, it's in the museums, it's all around us. And I think when I wanted to do a show that showed environmental health as well as the arts and speak to someone who's been an advocate for us as human beings, I reached out to Clyde Butcher, and he joined us on Maximum Health. He's done so much for education of the environment, for the Everglades, through his photography and through his books, that it's just amazing how much one person can do in a lifetime. Here's a bit from Clyde Butcher.
Under all these aspects of what it takes to do what you've done, now there's a soul of it. And
right.
Obviously there's a bigger purpose here than just taking pretty pictures of, right. of the earth. Now, where did that come from? Where does that drive?
I don't know. This may be sound like a Star Trek thing or something, but my grandmother and her sister were psychics. They actually made their living being a psychic. And I can just feel a photograph when I see it. I've had people with me that when I take a picture, and they look at the print, and they'll swear they weren't there when I took it. So it's something that I just have a way of feeling. I call it art comes from the heart. I mean, everybody has a camera. I mean, everybody's got a cell phone. But I can do great, you know, we can do great pictures with cell phones. You just have to be able to feel what it is. And that's something you can't teach. If you could explain it, you probably wouldn't be art. The impact that humans are having on the world. I mean, you know, saving the Everglades is really important, but unless we get a worldwide situation going, it's not going to do any good. So people got to start looking at the big picture and not just the local picture. I know it's important to look at the local picture, but unless you look at the big one, it's all going to be gone anyhow. So that's my concern, is globally, mm-hmm. that we're just the corporations have got, big business has got us, you know, I don't know how you change it. Because apparently our government people don't care about the world. All they care about is their next election.
So that was just a small selection for you to hear. And I really hope you're as excited as I am for the coming weeks and months and years of Maximum Health, Quality Living with yours truly, Dr. Ken Gray, Holistic Physician. I look forward to meeting here with you every Friday at 7 p.m. on 88.9 FM WQCS, National Public Radio of the Palm Beaches.